Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Hello and welcome. It's a pleasure today to be joined by S.J. Sindhu. Who is she? She is a Tamil diaspora author of two literary novels, two hybrid chapbooks, and a forthcoming graphic novel. Her first novel, Marriage of a Thousand Lives, won the Publishing Triangle Edmund White Award. That's a mouthful. And was a Stonewall Honor book and a finalist for a Lambda Literary Award. Sindhu's second novel, Blue Skin Gods, published in 2021, November, by Soho Press. Graphic novel, Shakti, and she'll be telling us about another one, is Shakti is forthcoming from HarperCollins. Sindhu's hybrid fiction and nonfiction chapbook called I Once Met You, But You Were Dead, what a title, won the Turnbuckle Chapbook Contest and was published by Split Lip Press. And her hybrid nonfiction and poetry chapbook, Dominant Genes, won the Black River Chapbook Competition, has been published?
Yeah.
February 2022, that's right, yes. By Black Lawrence Press, which is a friend of the podcast. A 2013 Lambda Literary Fellow, Sindhu holds an MA in English from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and a PhD in English and Creative Writing from Florida State University. Sindhu teaches at the University of Toronto, Scarborough. Dr. Sindhu, what a pleasure to have you. How are you today?
Thank you for having me. I am great.
Awesome. How did I do on the bio? I know some of the
I corrected
some of the dates and stuff, but you are
just
too dang prolific. That's the problem. Man. Well, obviously a very accomplished career with much to come in the future. I'd love to know how it kind of began. Your upbringing, you know, what were you reading? Were you the library kid? Were you, was it oral stories mixed with the reading? Like, was it a print-rich environment in your home? How did that work with reading and writing in your, especially in your younger days?
I was totally the library kid. I moved to the US when I was 7 from Sri Lanka. I didn't know English. And so my parents were like, okay, we moved in May, at the end of May. So I had the entire summer to basically learn English before I started third grade.
No pressure.
Right. They were like, how do we do this? So they got me cable. And like fancy cable, we had the Ooh. Disney Channel,
yes.
And which was like a big deal then. So I basically watched the Disney Channel and spent my time in the library trying to teach myself English. Uh-huh. And sort of worked, I guess. I started school in the fall. I was in ESL classes for, you know, a few years. And I had, it took them, I think, a whole semester to find me an interpreter. Mm. So for a semester, I was just sort of like floundering around. And my only ways of really learning the language, besides just sitting in class, was, you know, talking to other kids, which I didn't really like to do because I was an introvert, reading books in the library, and then watching Disney Channel and Cartoon Network. So that's essentially what I did. And so, you know, my knowledge of English is very much tied to stories and storytelling. And so I started out, you know, at the very low end of the library, the picture books, the sort of children's sections. And then I very quickly sort of advanced to, you know, chapter books. And then soon I was reading adult novels because I thought they were more interesting than what the kid lit of the 90s offered. Mm-hmm. which was not, you know, KidLit nowadays is amazing and offers so much more. But KidLit of the 90s was not very diverse or edgy in any way, right? It was very safe. So I was reading a lot of adult novels at that time. And I fell in love with Harry Potter, which, you know, saying it now is sort of like, there's political implications with that. And I do not condone J.K. Rowling or anything that she believes in terms of trans people. But at that time, that's what I was in love with. I was in love with Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a lot of nonfiction in high school. That was sort of my beginning with writing.
Wow.
I wrote a ton of fan fiction, and one of my fan fiction stories became really popular on LiveJournal back when LiveJournal was a thing. People would email me and be like, are you gonna release the next chapter of this thing? And it was a Wolfstar story, which is like a romance between Sirius Black and Remus Lupin in the Harry Potter universe. And I got my first taste of what having an audience felt like, and having a sort of audience that's sort of waiting for your next release feels like. And I got really kind of addicted. And when I started college as a computer science major, but I started taking creative writing classes, and there was no going back after that.
Since
I took my first creative writing class in college, I've been sort of tunnel visioned. I knew what I wanted to do, and there was nothing that was going to stop me, really.
Oh man. Well, so what was on the Disney Channel in those days? I'm trying to think. Oh. Like, that's before like Raven, I guess, probably, right?
There was some. I remember That's So Raven, but I think I was a little bit older. I think it was like Lizzie McGuire was on. I still think I was a little bit older.
Sure.
The first thing I remember watching is a rerun of The Lion King. And I think it was around that time. It was like 94, 95 when like The Lion King was being screened on TV. That's the first thing I remember watching. And I was like, I was so bored because I didn't know what was going on and I couldn't understand any of the English. And I was just like, what is happening?
Yes. Yeah. Well, you have no way of knowing, but that's a little traumatic for me, The Lion King, because I lost the school. I was running for school president. And the movie had just come out, and my opponent, who later won, she used Hakuna Matata as her slogan.
Wow.
Which was a great, great call on her part. And she was a great president. So no hard feelings, I don't know much about the fan fiction world. Like, I mean, did you write like 20 installments or like two, like how did, and then with that, like you said, you know, you got addicted to the audience and you learned what it was to have an audience waiting. Like, did you see yourself like tailoring your work towards what they wanted, what the masses wanted?
No, I like, that is something that I'm really grateful for, is that I was never really tempted to ever tailor my work to what they wanted.
Sell out. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, okay, I'm going to write what I want to write. And some of the stuff really landed and some of it didn't. I think I wrote I released it chapter by chapter. Mm-hmm. And it was like an alternate universe retelling of the Marauders time.
Oh.
I think I had like 20 or so chapters, and I was only halfway through before I stopped. I just sort of abandoned it because I was getting serious about my writing in college. And I was like, once I went to college and I started actually making friends and actually like going to parties and stuff, I completely stopped updating my fan fiction.
Right. What else does it, I mean, is the fan fiction in the ether now, or what, could one find that?
One could. I wrote under a pseudonym, which I'm really glad I did. I think only one person has ever found it. Whoa. And that person like told me what, like how they found it. And they were like, you should probably get rid of this last bit if you never want somebody to find this. And I was like, thank you. And I got rid of it. And now I don't think anyone will find it.
Wow. Okay. Wow. Dang. You would have been great at computer science apparently then too. Jeez. Man, with those skills. I wonder about Tamil, the language. Was Tamil your first language?
Yes.
What stands out about Tamil maybe that helped you to become a great writer? Is it lyrical? Is it repetitive is not the term, but is there something, are there things about the language specifically that lend themselves to writing or that even connect to English? I don't know.
It's not connected to English at all, but it is a very lyrical language. Mm-hmm. I think, to me, it's a super hard language to learn because there are so many ways of saying the same thing. Mm-hmm. And each word has like, five different connotations. And mm-hmm. I really like everything that is written in Tamil, like Tamil lyrics, Tamil, poetry. It is very beautiful to listen to if you know what, if you can understand the language.
Yeah.
And even if you can't, the words themselves are really beautiful in how they sound. And so I think, I grew up watching Tamil movies, which are a lot like Bollywood movies. And they have songs and they have these, these super dramatic sort of arcs and the Tamil language itself in the lyrics of the songs are, I don't know. I think it lends itself to the poetry really well.
Mm-hmm. Like a built-in thesaurus, right? You're saying there are like five different ways they mean different connotations. You know how like in German, they have those compound words, excuse me.
Oh, yes.
Right, that are so ultra specific. I feel like maybe it's kind of like that, but that's interesting. You said, so the connotations are different, right? And I guess even like the way you say something could mean that it's sarcastic versus serious. I got to think that made you, quite a writer because it's just like, okay, being very precise with your language.
Right? Yeah, it's, we don't have a lot of compound words, but we do have a lot of like many different words that mean similar things, but very, very slightly different. Uh-huh. Like the word alupu is like, it's not quite restlessness. It's not quite boredom. Mm. It's not quite ennui, but it's like somewhere in there. And it's like, there's different ways of describing words like, and I talk about this in the novel, words like love have many, many different words for all the different kinds of love that you can possibly feel. Mm-hmm. So it's it's a very precise language.
Oh, that was a great really part of the book.
Appreciate.
That was a great part of the book. Was that when the main character was still in India, or was that when he'd moved to the States?
That was when he finds his birth mother and he's sort of like ruminating on the language and the word mother itself and right. trying to figure out how to what to call her.
Uh-huh. Even that word being used like as a verb. That scene, and we'll get to the book in a little bit, but that scene is is so good because it's not because like the lack of pop. The lack of emotion, right? It's not some Disney, hey mom, I miss you all these years. It's realistic, it seems like, right? I mean, there's just so many barriers between them. I don't know if barriers is the word, but yes, it's not a love or hatred. It's just kind of a right? Blueskin Gods takes place in the state of Tamil Nadu. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What is the connection between, you know, that's the southernmost state of India, connection between that and the Tamil people? So the Tamil as an ethnic group, right? Is there a huge distinction between the Tamils of Sri Lanka and the Tamils of India? Is there sort of camaraderie and a brotherhood, or is it?
There is. And you know, the actual like sea space between Tamil Nadu and the northern tip of Sri Lanka is actually very small. Mm-hmm. Like you can make that journey in a canoe if you wanted. Like, yeah. It's very, very small. Uh-huh. It's not easy to make it in a canoe, but people do. People have done it with rowboats before. Mm. So it's actually very small. And there's been, you know, evidence of migration, you know, back and forth over thousands of years. But the fact that the northern sort of Tamil population of Sri Lanka has been isolated, fairly isolated from Tamil Nadu for so long means that our dialect is different. Right, so our language has sort of shifted and grown apart. We're still speaking Tamil and we can still sort of understand each other, but Sri Lankan Tamil speak a I guess a more archaic version of the language.
Yeah.
We our intonation, our cadences, our pronunciation is much more classical.
Right.
And Tamil Nadu Tamils tend to have a lot more slang, a lot more, they have a sort of drawl that is sort of like a Texan drawl with English. They squeeze out the vowels a little bit and they like draw them out. And it's really interesting to me.
Wow.
And they have, we'll have two different words that we use for the same thing.
Sure.
So that's, it's really interesting to compare. But I think, you know, Tamil movies used Indian Tamil. And so I feel like Sri Lankans can often understand Indian Tamil, but Indians often can't understand
the other way around
Sri Lankan Tamil. Yeah. Because ours is a little bit more classical and a little bit closer to written like formal Tamil.
Okay. So again, the language hipsters, right?
Yes.
I was that's so interesting, right? Like this idea of like almost like a preserved language.
Yeah.
You know, like the Turkish Cypriots on the island of Cyprus, right? They're maybe speaking the original Turkish, maybe, or you know, that hasn't, or you know, like Albanians in Italy and all over the world. That's so interesting. Wow. Go back to what you were reading as a kid, Harry Potter, and you know, like you said, that reminds me of that great saying, something about, I think it applies to racism and all kinds of isms, but it's like, why be racist when you can just be quiet? J.K. Rowling, right? Why be transphobic when you can just not say anything? Just, you know, am I playing like the armchair psychologist, or is there something about like an escape and a fantasy in reading, you know, being new to the language, new to the culture, especially when you're 7, 8, 9 years old, this idea of like reading as a refuge or an escape, not that things were horrible for you, but just like, you know, these are things that I know, friends, this is an escape. I wonder if that's true to life for you.
Yeah, I think it was. I was not the best at making friends in my youth, and I think like, you know, having a sort of challenge in like knowing written English really well, but not being able to sort of pronounce all the words. Because when you read a word, when you learn a word through reading, you don't know how to pronounce it. So you just sort of pronounce it in your head.
Yes.
And that doesn't lend itself to like friend making. You don't know any of the slang, you don't know any of the right. fun pop culture or anything. You're like this bookish nerd, which somehow now is like a popular thing, which is sort of bizarre to me, because I grew up Yeah, growing up in the 90s, that was not a thing. If you were a nerd, you were an outsider. And there was no cool points afforded to you as a nerd.
No.
Yeah. So it was an escape. I think, you know, I was really drawn to a lot of fantasy, a lot of I loved those books. I forget what they're called, but like it was essentially a book series in which someone would relive the same day. It was like Groundhog Day. Like someone would relive the same day every single day until they figured it out. And there was this whole series of those. And then there was Sideways Stories from Wayside School and all of these sort of like fabulous, surreal.
Right.
Stories. And that's what I loved. I loved sort of projecting myself into these worlds where I knew that that didn't exist, but that where I had thought I might be better off.
Yes. Tangentially related, have you seen Severance on Apple TV?
No.
Oh my gosh.
I've heard about it.
Oh my gosh. What a series. It's, you know, they call it, I mean, it's a sci-fi. It's sci-fi, which is not normally my bag. Man, it's good. Man. Huh. Yes. Okay. Check it out. But anyways, it reminded me of, you know, the fabulous, the fantasy type of thing for sure. Could you have articulated? I'm kind of skipping ahead. I'm not even asking the question first, but the question is, did you feel a representation? Did you feel like you saw yourself in what you read growing up? In, you know, again, in all the different fields. No. No period? No comma?
No period. Well, no semicolon, maybe. I don't know.
No M dash.
I definitely saw sort of spunky, feisty female protagonists, which was really important to me. There was a series about Cam, who was probably 12-year-old detective. Who like had a photographic memory. So like all of the cases would involve some sort of Cam's remembering of photographic memory.
Oh, I get it, Cam.
Yeah.
I get it. Yeah. Clever.
Yeah. But like it was those kinds of things that really interested me. Like I loved Hermione from Harry Potter. I was like to see women being able to sort of project themselves out of the expectations that were held for them was amazing.
Okay.
But at the same time, like there were no brown people in these stories. There was definitely no South Asian representation at all. And so like nothing I recognized, nothing that looked like my own life, nothing that reflected my own experiences as an immigrant, nothing like that. And so it's always been like now lately I've been getting into Kid Lit. Middle grade, YA, and part of my journey and project, I guess, agenda is to write the stories I needed to see, write the kind of representation I needed to have at that age. And I wish that I had at that age. And I think, it definitely didn't exist in the 90s.
Yeah. So, I mean, I got to assume that's some motivation to, I mean, as great as the work you do is like Blue Skin Gods, that's, you know, more for the adults. Right. So that's probably been some motivation to write for younger readers because it's like, all right, if we don't get whatever the 12, the 16 year old, they may not become a 35-year-old reader. Right. Is that kind of fair to say?
Yeah. I think if you don't provide mirrors when people are young, they're not going to trust the literary experience as they grow older.
Oh man, those great quotes about the mirrors and the windows, you know, with reading. That's awesome. As you got into high school, college, What were you reading? Did you start to see and feel that representation, whether they're immigrant stories, whether South Asian stories, whether, all the different cultures that make us up, subcultures, who really thrilled you as you got into high school and college and inspired you?
In high school, I read one of the very first sort of South Asian novels that came across my purview, I guess. It was called Born Confused by Dhanuja Desai Hidier. And it was a YA sort of romance novel, but I had never seen something like that before. And it's still like Born Confused is still, I think, one of the first representations that really broke through the publishing barrier and gave us the kind of sort of South Asian American experience in a novel where we got to be the main character. And that was amazing. The other one was like Interpreter of Maladies by John Polihiri, won the Pulitzer Prize.
It was a decent book. Yeah, it was all right.
When I was in high school, and I was like, oh wow, okay. So we're really like there's a sea change happening. Mm-hmm. And I started to realize that the publishing industry was paying attention to South Asian voices for maybe the first time. And I also started to think in, you know, my senior year that maybe I wanted to contribute to that.
Oh, wow. So what was the moment or moments? What were the eureka moments where you're like, you know, was it the fanfic? Was it something in a workshop? You talk about those, you know, like going into writing in college, and man, we all remember those workshops, right? Those could be nerve wracking, but also like incredible victories, you know? So yeah, I mean, what was it? Or was there a moment or moments where you're just like, okay, I can do this for a living. People dig my work.
I think there were several. There was definitely the time in 12th grade when I read Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, and I realized that, you know, I could maybe write about war, because I was, you know, my early childhood was spent in the Sri Lankan Civil War. And I was like, okay, I don't know how to make sense of these experiences. Mm-hmm. And having the things I left or the things I carried as a model for how to write about war was really important to me. I was like, oh, wow, I've never seen such a lyrical, nuanced, beautiful, complex reflection on what war is. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, maybe I could do this. And then in college, I took a writing workshop with the writer Timothy Shaffert. And we were in a basement, in a windowless basement room. It was a night class. And I knew then, sitting in that class, that's what I wanted. I wanted it so badly. I was like, okay, here's a writer who is making it work. I mean, he's queer, he's in Nebraska, and he's like writing these books, and he's a full-time writer at this point, and he's very soft-spoken, like very kindly, but very like astute in his feedback. Mm-hmm. And I had never had that kind of attention paid to my work before. Yeah. And I was like, okay, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. I can see my future, and this is it.
Did you hold a press conference?
So if you talk about her.
Did you hold a press conference?
Yeah, well, if you're talking, well, I did. I told my, because I was in this honors sort of computer science business management program where you like, it was like this whole deal, and we had to like talk to people to actually get out of it. And so, yeah, it was sort of, I had to like go through all these steps, and I had to inform my parents. Yeah. And that did not go very well. so yeah, it was a whole ordeal.
Well, where did the encouragement keep coming? Was it mostly, you know, was it mostly self-motivation for a while? You know, how did you keep going when it was difficult? You had to change majors. You had to maybe you displeased a couple people. How did you keep going with it? You know, what were maybe some of the early publications too, that kind of thing?
It was mostly professors, actually. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of self-doubt. I didn't really know what I was doing. And in high school, I took environmental science, and we went to this swamp as a field trip, and we had to write field journals. And I wrote this field journal, and I turned it in, and my environmental science teacher, who it was AP environmental science in 12th grade, and he was like, his only response was, "You should consider being a writer." And I was like, "Oh, interesting. Okay." I really, for some reason, that really sort of lodged itself in my brain. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Tim Schaffer, with whom I took that class, and almost every writing professor I had at the University of Nebraska was so encouraging.
That's cool.
They just were like, you can make it. Mm-hmm. You can do it if you wanted to. Mm-hmm. Why don't you do it? Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, fine. I think I can do it. So it was really just my professors who were very, very, not just encouraging, but also like very supportive. And yeah. They lent me their time, and they read my work outside of class hours. And yeah, they were just really, really generous.
Wow. Very cool. How did the you know, I guess the fairly short writing, how did that, you know, turn into books? And, you know, I'd love to hear about Marriage of a Thousand Lies, which was heavily awarded. It wasn't like my first book is thrown out in the world. Like it got a lot of praise. You know, what was kind of like the genesis of Marriage of a Thousand Lies?
It started off as a short story. I was starting my master's program at the University of Nebraska, and I was like, okay, I don't really know what I'm doing. I was like 20 years old, and I really had no idea. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, let's just take this class. And it was a novel class with John S.A.G., who's a very accomplished novelist. Mm. And she was basically like, okay, take the short story, whatever short story has been sort of still like has its claws in you, okay, after you wrote it, and make it into a novel. And I was like, okay, all right. There was a story that kept bothering me after I wrote it. I was like, I couldn't get it out of my head. And so I started turning it into a novel in that class, and it turned into Marriage of a Thousand Lies. It was my thesis for my master's program. And then I took 2 years off of school, and I worked, and I did all sorts of weird jobs. And at the same time, I revised the novel, and it was a time when I learned a lot about who I was as a writer, but also who I am as a person. Mm-hmm. It was really nice.
That's really cool. Are those weird jobs going to find their way into your writing down the road, or have they already?
Maybe. I haven't actually. I was a proofreader for Pearson. Pearson is the company that owns Penguin Random House, and but Pearson actually does the educational stuff. So
right.
They publish the textbooks.
Yes.
And I was a proofreader, and it was this really weird, wild environment. All the proofreaders hung out and played board games during lunch, and it was really interesting. I want to write about that at some point.
Yeah. Well, I have only good things to say about the Pearson textbooks I've used as a teacher over the years. So thank you. You know, good stuff. And all that was done, you know, over board games. Okay, cool. Blue Skin Gods is the one we're going to talk mostly about. And wow, what an accomplishment. It's current, you know, it's one of those that, you know, has, you know, apps and, you know, dating apps and technology and stuff, but it's not dated. Even I love to ask you about like kind of the first part of the book, which takes place back in India, kind of like what years maybe you picture those as being, or whether that matters or not. But anyways, I love to know, and I sometimes ask the writers to give a summary, and the book, I mean, I guess you could, but it's like, there's so many cool ins and outs, and we want to stay away from plot spoilers because those twists. But I guess, again, what was the genesis of that? It's steeped in mythology and more, you know, religious, you know, texts. I would love to know where that came from.
Again, maybe it was a short story. It was a short story that was trying to explore religiosity, because this was like 2013. It was a time when Hindu fundamentalism was on the rise in India. And I found that really weird and interesting, because in Sri Lanka, I had been persecuted, and we had been persecuted as a family for being Hindu. So it was really interesting to me, you know, in a bad way, that sure. Hindus in India were persecuting other religious minorities. So I started researching it, and I started talking about it and thinking about it. And then I read these headlines about fake gurus and all these cults that were happening in India. You know, Bikram yoga was a thing.
Oh, man.
And yeah, like there was just so many. And I saw some of my friends get like lured into some of the stuff. Mm. And I really wanted to write about it. I really did. Mm. And so I wrote this short story that was sort of magical realist, in that, you know, the instead of having blue skin, the central character grows wings. And once he grows wings, there's this belief in his village that if you have a feather, if you're bestowed with a feather from his wings, you will be healed of any ailment. Mm. And at the end of the story, spoiler, whatever, this like mob sort of converges on him and plucks his wings. They just like pluck, you know, keep plucking until he has no feathers anymore. Mm. And I loved that sort of bringing together religiosity, but also violence, because I think those two are sometimes very intricately linked. Sure. Yeah, so that's
the word fanaticism, right? I mean, fanaticism.
Yes.
Can be. Yeah. I was just rereading part of the book where just the idea of, I think when, you know, when his cousin leaves, this idea of like that sadness that becomes in the religious text became anger, you know, where like his dad was like, mm-hmm. Hey, stop crying. And he's like, well, that happened in the text too. And it was often a, you know, huge smoldering anger. Now, you probably would have been sued by the Marquez estate, though, right? Maybe Gabriel Garcia Marquez estate might have sued
him. I mean, like, he doesn't own the wings, right?
So, exactly. You're right. I'm just kidding. Would somebody who has read Blue Skin Gods recognize that? Like, did that like directly go into the book, even though it wasn't the wings, or was it like you just
no.
Kind of general idea.
I really just took the wings and only the wings from that story. So I don't think so.
Okay. Obviously, you know, it's called Blue Skin Gods, and blue is described in the book, and just in general knowledge is, you know, it's being warm, and flame can also be cold. Mm-hmm. Right. And I wonder about the title. Did the title come right away, or was it more like the events of the book and then the title came later? Which informed which,
you know,
I guess, or maybe both?
It really depends on the book. So like for this book, Blue Skin Gods, I had the title before I even started writing.
Okay.
I knew what it was going to be called. And like on the first draft, I put Blue Skin Gods. Marriage of a Thousand Lies did not work that way. That was actually a title. It went through like five or six different titles.
Whoa.
And Marriage of a Thousand Lies was like the last title I slapped on it before I sent it to an agent. Mm. Honestly, like it was just, I was like, I need a title. They're probably going to change it later. I'll just put this on there. And then when they didn't change it later, I was kind of upset. I was like, oh no, this is the title. Yeah.
Oh man, it worked. It worked. You know, obviously there's a lot of parallels to religious texts with the blue skin. We'll talk about in a second. I don't know how you pronounce it. The Fugate family, like in Kentucky.
I think it's Fugates.
Fugate. Okay. These were real blue skin people, right? Mm-hmm. And so I wonder about like research you did both on like the religious texts and like, you know, the American example and I'm going to have you say the word, please. Cause the name of the illness or the name of the, I want to say maybe it starts with an M.
Yeah, it's methemoglobinemia.
Thank you. So yeah, you know, research, I mean, was it like, when, you know, did you find out about the Fugate family later, or was it like, oh my gosh, and that kind of really propelled the story forward?
It was the second. Like I knew that I wanted a kid who was being forced into this title as a guru to mm-hmm. lead a people and maybe heal a people. Right. And then I smashed it with the my research on the Fugate family.
Yeah.
Where, you know, this like extremely recessive gene had produced actual blue skinned people. Mm-hmm. And so I like smooshed these two ideas together and got this novel.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Vishnu and the like the blue skinned Hindu god. I don't know if he was the only one or others who I think were represented as blue skinned.
A lot of Hindu gods are just depicted as blue skinned. Okay. But as my protagonist Kalki says, you know, we don't really know why that is. It might be because there were a lot of gods in indigenous Indian, you know, belief that were really dark skinned, reflecting the skin color of the people that lived there. Mm. And then eventually when, you know, we know that there were several rounds of migrations, each sort of lightening in color, because the original migrations, which formed the basis of the Thamil people, mm-hmm. were very dark skinned. It was very early on out of Africa. And the kind of Indian people that we like have now associated with India with like sort of golden caramel skin and you know, that like the Priyanka Chopra type of people came much later, right? Mm-hmm. They came from Central Asia rather than like straight out of Africa.
Right.
So there's like different gene pools we're working with. Mm. And the idea is that, you know, the lighter skinned people who took over most of India were not thrilled about these super, super dark skinned indigenous gods. And so when they absorbed them into the pantheon, these gods became blue skinned because it was better than being dark skinned.
Right.
So it was really an act of colorism to change from dark skin to blue skin.
Sure. Wow. Thank you for that. So there's Kalki Sami. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah. You're actually doing really good on the pronunciation.
I appreciate that. I did my homework, you know. You know, is the main character seen as this reincarnation of, as another avatar? Is that safe to say?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, through the prophecies and the religious texts. Now, here I go again. Is the stress on the last letter. So Aya for the father?
Aya.
Okay. Aya.
Yeah. Equal stress.
Okay. Oh, I see. Okay. Because in Espanol, Aya is like over there. Aya. Aya. Right. Mm. So he's the exploiter, right? He's mm-hmm. a doctor who I believe who spent some time in the US before, right? Before mm-hmm. moving back, right? And he's, you know, towards the beginning, you don't necessarily see him as 100% conniver. At least I didn't. You know, but you get some clues, right? there's an article in the local paper, you know, and he talks about this is exactly the exposure we need. You know, just being very extremely secretive, to say the least. I don't want to, you know, blow one of the huge secrets at the end. He's crafty. He's craven. He treats his wife horribly. When Kalki Sami gets to be 10, he has a major test of his miracles, right? He kind of helped to heal people, kind of, and there was really kind of plausible deniability, right? Whether yes, he did. Yes, he did. You could, you know, tell us a little bit about Rupa and how she was like a test for him. And then later how she became part of his life.
So Kalki, when he's 10, he's supposed to get these three tests to right. prove that he is in fact the second coming, the 10th coming of sure. Vishnu.
Sure.
And so Rupa is the first test. So she is a very sickly girl who is brought to the ashram where Kalki is, and the hospitals don't know what to do with her. The clinics, the doctors that they have seen, like, can't fix her illness. She's basically whittling away. She's mm-hmm. sort of skin and bones when she meets Kalki. And he is in charge of healing her. That's his first test. And so, like, he is this enormous burden on a 10-year-old.
Right.
And he's, you know, he's trying everything he can think of. And mm-hmm. and there is something that goes a little bit awry with her healing, in that his aunt feeds her something while he's watching. And then as soon as he feeds her something, she starts to get better. And so Kalki starts to doubt his own divinity. But then he has these two other tests that he needs to pass. And he mm-hmm. seems to pass the second test just fine. The third test goes terribly, and he ends up, you know, losing part of his family. But then, like, Rupa is given to the ashram, which is a fairly normal practice for when, you know, somebody is healed in that kind of miraculous way, where she's sort of promised to mm-hmm. the ashram, in the way that, like, young women were promised to monasteries or nunneries in the past.
Right.
So she's given to the ashram, and she sort of grows up along with Kalki. And when he's a teenager, he starts to fall in love with her. And she becomes his first love.
For sure. And then, so we have Lakshman. I call him the frenemy cousin. right. You know, they're kids together. They play fight. You know, there's Rupa as the third wheel, or, right, or this idea of like you know, like a love triangle, maybe, you know, and the same, you know, mm-hmm. as kids would have, and, you know, and they have great times together as well. And but there's, you know, there's also like the bathing incident, right, where was it maybe the mom was out of town or something like that, mm-hmm. and right, and so Kalki is bathing, and there's that whole process that mom had done with, you know, to keep the water blue, and, you know, and Lakshman is asking the same questions that we're probably asking his reader, like, how do you, what's natural, what's not, and all that. But also you do a really great job in connecting the Lakshman and Kalki relationship with, what would that be, Rama and Vishnu?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so what, talk about the parallels there, if you would, about, you know, who was the helper, who was the God, and, I mean, we know that, but how they were connected.
Yeah, it's Rama and Lakshman. So Rama is the eighth incarnation or seventh incarnation of Vishnu, and it is the biggest, like, sort of, so he's the hero of the Ramayana, which is one of the big Sanskrit epics. And Ram's younger brother is named Lakshman, and he is, like, Ram's most devoted brother.
Mm-hmm.
He is the only brother who follows Ram into the woods after he is exiled from his kingdom. He's the only brother who's, like, you know, willing to wage war on behalf of Ram at the end. You know, there's only one instance in which they fight, and this comes up in the book as well. But so Ram is the hero, or Ram is the god, and Lakshman is portrayed as the hero. And in the Mahabharata, it is very similar, where Krishna is the god and Arjun is the hero. Arjun is sort of, you know, Krishna's very devoted friend. They're not actually related, but they're very good friends, and they remain so until the very end. So there's this like sort of relationship predicted in these texts. And so these two boys fashion themselves and their own relationship from these texts, because that's what they've been told. And so Kalki is a little bit older, not very much older. They're basically the same age, but Kalki is like a few months older.
Right.
And he's, you know, maybe a year older, and he's sort of decided that he is the leader, but he's not a very good leader. He doesn't have any of like leader, you know, any of the leadership qualities we would expect. But Lakshman does. He is charismatic. He's funny. He's good looking. He can sort of like predict what people need to hear and what people want to hear at a particular moment, whereas Kalki is sort of awkward and bookish.
Right.
So I wanted to create that imbalance, in that Lakshman is much better suited to this role that Kalki has been given.
Very true.
And so because of that, he gets really jealous. And, you know, they're 9 and 10 years old. Of course they, you know, of course Lakshman would get jealous. And so I wanted to sort of explore this friendship and this deep camaraderie with this imbalance in power and imbalance in situation.
Right. Ah, very interesting. I'm reminded in a really great way of Amir and Hassan from The Kite Run. I don't know if you've read The Kite Run.
Yes, I have. I have.
Right. Hassan. Sorry. But yeah, there's with Hassan, you know, he doesn't have that, what you're talking about. He doesn't have that jealousy. He's like incredibly innocent and pure, but I see a lot of that, you know, there's that imbalance that always comes between, like, that's not the right, but like, you know, like a boss and a worker. You know what I mean? Like, as much as they're related or they're friends, it's like, it's, you know, so that's but that's a great comparison, and that was a really great relationship. Like, you talk about Lakshman is such a charismatic guy, you might even say a rock star. We'll get to that. Right, such a cool narrative structure, the flash forwards, the flashbacks. Man, I got that thrill when I was reading the book, and I was like, whoa, this was written by Kalki later as a professor. Like this, like he wrote this book, right? Mm-hmm. S.J. Sindhu may be on the cover, but this is really, you know what I mean? And just like the fact that he was so much steeped in religion as a kid. Yes, it was a fake religion. Yes, it was cultish. Yes, it was, but he was so, that was his life. And then in the end, he's really just disabused of that notion. I don't think I've ever said that phrase in my life. Did I use it right? Disabused of the notion, you know, of religion is positive, right? Because religion was obviously was a very detrimental part of his life. But it was just so cool. I wonder how you were able to get in the mind of the 10, 15, 17 year old Kalki, and also the, you know, whatever 40 year old, or, you know, however old he was as a professor.
I lost my faith when I was fairly young. But I think for sure, when by the time I was 16, 17, I was starting to be like, okay, atheism. I want to research this, because I think this is what I believe. And so I think for me, I was trying to channel that. He's a little late, in that he's 22 when he really, you know, walks away. But like, I remember being 22. I remember that, like, who am I stage in your life, where you're trying to really understand what you believe and what is, you know, what you want your life to look like. And then, you know, the middle-aged Kalki is sort of me right now, being like, okay, I can deal with Kalki right now, like where mm-hmm. where he's sort of my age when he's writing this novel. Sure. And the moment I figured it out that it was Kalki's like faux memoir, that was a huge moment in revising the novel. I was lost. I was like, why am I writing this? What's the exigence? Like, you know, what am I doing? Mm-hmm. What is this? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, my partner and I were on a hike in Cherokee, North Carolina. And I like walked onto the hiking path and I was like, oh my God, it's a faux memoir. Kalki is writing his own memoir and that's the book. And that changed everything. It changed everything. It allowed me to return to the novel with a new, with a new agenda of revision.
Okay.
And that is what ended up becoming the final version.
Right. And so cool. So the, gosh, dang it. I always forget this term, but the idea, and this is a Latin term, but you started in the middle in some ways, right? The book starts with that, the after effects of that, of the auto rickshaw accident. And it's like, all right, Kalki, do your thing. Right. And you do such a good job of, again, of the back and forth. And that comes up again later in the book. I'm always a fan of that. Like, oh, okay, now this has a different meaning than it did at the beginning, right? But also just like getting inside the head of somebody who kind of believes that he's a god and can be pushed either way. And like you said, you know, he does okay on some of the miracles, even the ones where people don't help him out by giving them medicine. Like he kind of channels something and he's just kind of maybe like a positive energy, whatever, and it kind of works, right? So it's just really well done with the way that we go back and forth. And like I said, we get the different perspectives, the middle-aged Kalki, the young, and even the omniscient at times, right? It's not exactly broken in half the book, but there is this idea of like a common era, you know, BC, AD, CE, BCE, of like him going to New York is, you know, changes the whole book to be, you know, obviously, right? His faith is tested even more. He definitely does not get along well with his father in New York. I think of his father sitting at the bar waiting to accost him, you know, that kind of thing. But I want to talk more about the themes of faith. Back in India, when Kalki was still seen as a god of some sort, Sita comes as a guest. And I thought she was a really interesting character. She's kind of, I think you might have literally had her wearing pants, right? She's not, you know, she's a woman's, in the term, back in the old fashioned term, she's women's lib. She's, you know, forward thinking, right? She doesn't have any man tell her what to do. She's very independent. Kind of, you know, probably coming from a richer family, it sounds like, right? Mm-hmm. I'm kind of like, what was she doing there? Was she there for just like rest and relaxation? But anyways, she brings books with her. And whether we're talking about literally a religious faith or just like getting to know the world, right? Because Kalki lived in such a sheltered, protected environment by his dad who wanted to keep his investment, right? What a cool character. I wonder where Sita came in and, you know, where you put her in the narrative. Like, was she someone you wanted to have right away?
I wanted someone to introduce the world to Kalki in a way that didn't take him out of the ashram quite yet, because he needed to stay in the ashram for longer for his arc to actually work. But I wanted him to have connections with the outer world. And so that's kind of how Sita started, is that I wanted a person who could introduce Kalki to the bigger questions of the world, and specifically through literature, because I was in the middle of my PhD at this point, and I was like, okay, I'm reading all this stuff, I my own mind is being broken and broken open, sure, and expanded, and I wanted to give that to my main character, and so that's kind of what Sita was at the beginning. And then I also wanted, I was very aware that, you know, I'm, it's me writing this young brown boy and this young Tamil boy. And I wanted to create female characters, women characters in the book, femme characters who are going to not fit the traditional notions of or what women's role is within a male story. So essentially, like at the end, this is still Kathy's story, but I wanted to make sure that the women around him were unusual and exceptional.
While, you know, while his mother was under the thumb of his father, she was a an exceptional character. She was a great artist. She was a beautiful artist. She, you know, she didn't always follow the rules. She didn't always follow convention. She would take him into the town to make the phone calls and kind of like, but dad was going to, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Right. She was very independent in her own ways. And obviously, you know, a lot of the depression came from just being treated so horribly. Sita, you have as the window to the outside world. Like you said, she traveled and she brings him Chopin's the awakening. Right. So it's, it was truly an awakening to him, like, whoa, there's so much out there to see. And like you say, it's kind of a, it's like a precursor to his New York trip, right? Like, okay, I'm still here in the ashram, but it's planting those seeds down the road. Another theme of the book is, you know, sickness comes in so many forms. This idea of like the mind and body connection, right? Like a, almost like a panacea type thing, or placebo, excuse me. Exploitation and selfishness. Did you, for the character of Aya, like, did you, who's the exploiter, did you look more specifically at like religious charlatans, or did you look more at like a Trump, like political, or all of the above?
Well, both. I mean, I had no idea that when this book came out, Trump would be president. Like, I could never have predicted because when I was writing it, I mean, Trump was
like, he was a joke. He wasn't.
That was not that. Yeah, he was a joke. And so, like, the seeds of Aya took place before any of that happened. And I think, like, later on, as Trump assumed the presidency, and as, you know, I think I sold the novel in 2019. So he'd been president for about 3 months or 3 years. I don't know. Time is weird right now. But he'd been president for 3 years, and I sort of like, I shifted Aya's character to include some of the stuff, of the Trumpian things.
Sure.
But it, originally he started off as modeled after the charlatans that had existed. So the people who had sort of brought, not just in Hindu cults and in Hindu, like, sort of guru following, but also like Scientology and other kinds of, you know, modern day cults that, that we've seen come through. I studied cult leaders and what they were like, and the kinds of things that they actually believed. And I think, you know, I made a decision early on that, like, Aya was going to be a full believer. Like, he's going to believe that he is right, that Kalki is the last incarnation of Vishnu, and that this is going to bring peace to the world. Like, that is a foundational belief that Aya has, that it needed to be in order to write his character. Like, he believes that he is correct. Not just in like a this is good for Kalki way, but in a, this is good for the world, and I am a maverick through prophet way.
Yes. He, you know, he's not a morally good character, but what a well-drawn character. Like, he's, I mean, he could easily have been like a stereotype, or you know, what's the word? Just like an overdone character. Cause there are some like that, right? Like, oh, you know, the world needs this, but it doesn't know it. I'm here to give it, you know, that kind of thing. But yeah, he, just the way that you draw the character is so well done, because it's not, he's fleshed out. He's not like a simplistic character, for sure. And yeah, I don't know. I believe there's probably a part of him that's like, you know, this is good for them, right? We're helping them, you know, whether it's a placebo or not, that kind of thing. So yeah, there's a great quote talking about, well, first of all, man, I would love to, like, if there's a sequel or like a spinoff, or maybe, or maybe I'll do fan fiction on this. I love the meeting of the child god, right? In New York. I can't remember her name.
Sunita.
Right. So Sunita was also, you know, in a similar condition as Kalki, as far as like, you know, the guru, you know, seen as like the, as a god, and, you know, not that that Buddha's reference here, but like a, or like the, you know, like a young Dalai Lama or young Buddha, or, but you know, that kind of thing. And she realizes also like how much of a scam it really was for her to be that. That was just so cool. Like for him to be able to talk to someone else like that. And also in a different, in a removed society, in a different country, in a different place, and obviously much older. But, you know, Kalki talks about, or maybe it's in one of his monologues, is, quote, angry at the world for believing it, angry at the world for believing in him, and believing in his powers, right? And this idea of, quote, you can't trick someone who doesn't want to be tricked. People who, I'm so, this idea of cognitive dissonance, right? Or people who just cannot be told something different. Oh man, I voted for that guy, not naming any names. He was not what I thought he would be, but I'm going to stick with it because if I were to deny him, I'm denying myself, you know, that kind of thing. I wonder how that came into play in writing this book, this idea of, you know, a sucker's born every minute, or, you know, this idea of people just falling for things that can't possibly be true, or more so willing themselves to believe they're true, whether it's religious or not.
Well, I think, you know, I think we are living through a weird time right now, where, you know, my first experience with the U.S. election system was when Bush Jr. won. You know, where, you know, it was essentially a stolen election. And I was like, oh, my God. If that can happen in the U.S., like, then what hope do we have? I mean, this is supposed to be the most stable country in the world, and yet it can happen here. And it was a moment where I was like, okay, everything we believe is false. Everything is not true. And so I became very cynical after that, after the Bush Gore election. And then watching it happen again, watching the exact same thing happen again was unbelievable. Right. It was unbelievable. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to think anymore. And I think, you know, that was a large part of the book as well. This idea of charlatans, of us wanting to believe something so badly that we let go of our critical thinking, our logic, our our values, everything, because we need something to be true so badly that we are going to forego everything else.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I love that idea. Like, I mean, I think we've all experienced it, not in this big way, but just like this idea of I'm angry at that person for believing it. Yes, I may be guilty in, you know, convincing them of something that's not true, it's a little white lie, whatever. But it's just like, there's that human thing. Like, how are you believing this? You know, like an anger, or almost like a, just being so confused. Guilt is obviously a very human emotion, and Kalki feels that throughout, you know, a lot of the time in New York City, just about he's his father's son. And while they don't have a good relationship, and his father has betrayed him in many, many ways, he's also like, you know, this idea of, I need this fealty to my father, almost like a Stockholm syndrome. Right. And, you know, going against all beliefs. Right. And also, of course, the guilt for like, what have I done to those people who believe? Like, what about the letdown? You know, the themes of class and difference. I think we talked about that a little bit with Kalki, even versus like his cousin, and, the, remind me, was it M, right? So M is the girlfriend of his cousin, Lakshman, mm-hmm. who he meets up with in New York. And she talks about, and she didn't necessarily have that close connection to her country, to her family's country, but she talked about being a Dalit, right? That like the untouchables, mm-hmm. as they say, you know, and Kalki's just kind of like, whoa, right? It's kind of shocking to him. You do such a good job with, I guess, like fluid sexuality in the book, where it's just like, it's not something that, I mean, I'm sure this would be a point we'd love to get to in our societies, right? Where it's like, yeah, and, you know, mm-hmm. you have the character of Han, who's, what is it, pansexual, is that the term?
Mm-hmm. Right? And polyamorous.
Polyamorous, that's right. And, you know, it's just kind of like, it's not a plot point necessarily. It's like just part of their lives. Again, going back to the parents, there's this like love and sacrifice, which definitely Kalki's mother does. But this idea of like, you need to be loyal to your father. But what if your father's a charlatan? You need to be loyal to your father. Man, you nailed it with that last line of the book. And I'm not going to say it again away. Not, you know, one of those sentences, you read it on its own. You're like, it's a good sentence. But just mm-hmm. in the context, just that cool way that there's a sort of payback for the father. And then it ends, and I feel like that's really a twist at the end, because he could have, I'm talking about Kalki, he could have reacted mm-hmm. so much differently, right? He could have kept going.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I just thought, how did you feel when you wrote that last line? Were you like, yep, that stays in there?
I mean, I wrote so many versions of that last scene. Mm-hmm. It has existed from the very first draft. That scene has, in some form or another, has mm-hmm. existed from the very first draft, because it knew the novel had to end with a confrontation between yes. Kalki and his father,
yes.
because that's how it begins. Mm. And I knew that that was the ending. I just didn't know like exactly what would happen. But yeah, like it's very similar from the very first draft, actually, oh, even wow. though this is draft 20 and that was draft one.
Whoa.
But that last line was a very late addition, because I wanted to give Kalki the opportunity for grace,
sure,
and which is like, you know, the thing that every god is supposed to have.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't have thought about that unless, like, you know, it's like this thing where, like, you know, at every moment that you're revising, you meet this person, or you're in this situation where you have an encounter that like reveals the next revision to you.
I see.
And at this moment, when I was trying to figure out the ending, I was living next to a Methodist pastor who was a woman, and who was like sort of trying to navigate the rupture in the Methodist church between the progressives and the conservatives. And, you know, as a woman pastor, she was sort of, you know, embroiled in that debate and had skin in the game.
Yes.
And she talked a lot about grace, and I was like, oh, okay. And this is a thing that sort of, again, lodged itself. And I was like, okay, Kalki needs to have a moment of grace, where he's able to perform the godly act of grace, which he's never been able to do before.
Mm-hmm. Yes, 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 yes. This is a book where, you know, the whole is definitely more than the parts. There's the guardian, which the vaunted guardian did a great review, and a couple of things that were written was, S.J. Sindhu's language is simple and clear. Her skills as a storyteller are so subtle that only halfway through the novel did I notice her differing ways with emotional effect. Yep. Blueskin Gods. So quote, Blueskin Gods is a rich, beautifully told and moving examination of the allure of superstition and legend, the pains of growing up, and the pitfalls of lying to yourself and lying to others and lying to yourself. Quote unquote, mic drop. Congratulations on an incredible book. We'd love to hear a little
Thank
bit
you.
If you're up to reading it.
Sure. I'm just going to read these two pages from the very like late part of the book, which I've never read from, actually.
Okay,
so this is the very first time. In between songs, Lakshman smiled and winked at the fans, asked them how they were, and told them charming little stories about the band's adventures. The songs were bizarre, irreverent their entire point. One song had two lyrical lines repeated over and over. I'm gonna swear right now. Two pigs in a bucket, fuck it. Another song was called Hare Krishna, which made me laugh. And another included the phrase, taking a poop in an abandoned mine. You're with the band, right? The bartender asked. He set a glass of beer in front of me, on the house. I took it and held it without drinking. At least it helped me blend in. Somewhere during the third song, I got curious and sipped the beer. It tasted like cool, fizzing liquid bread that had gone bad. I kept sipping, and the more the bubbles numbed my tongue, the easier it was to drink. Guilt tried to sneak in, but I kept drinking. Most of the world believes, and has always believed, in some sort of divine being or beings. Whether that's a single omniscient god, or many gods in complicated pantheons, or localized nature deities. But the number of people who had grown up believing they were divine beings themselves was very few. Later in life, when I told people about my upbringing, they often wondered what it does to a person to believe themselves a god. Sitting in the bar drinking my first beer, I didn't know what I believed. We had talked about it backstage before the show. Lakshman alleged that gods didn't exist, that science is all we have. M said she didn't know, but there's no way to know or prove the existence or non-existence of a god or gods, and Han agreed with her. Jason thought it didn't matter whether there is a god or not, because to be good human beings, we should always act like a benevolent god is watching. He told me this is known as Pascal's wager, named after the philosopher and mathematician Blaise Pascal, who believed that the best cost-benefit analysis pointed to us living our lives as if a god exists. Because if god exists, then we're in the clear. And if god doesn't exist, we don't lose much by being good people. I didn't know anymore if I believed in a god or gods. But Hinduism is more than the existence of divine beings. Hindu philosophy is also about karma, reincarnation, dharma, maya, and moksha, all forces within the universe that exist independently of our large pantheon of gods. Karma, the sum total of the good and bad choices we make in life. Reincarnation, the cycle of birth and rebirth, where we live out the rewards and punishments for our karma. Dharma, the righteous path. Maya, the illusions of the world that tempt us into veering off our dharma. Moksha, the self-actualization that leads to the final release from our reincarnation cycle. In Hinduism, these concepts are laws of the universe, like gravity, or thermodynamics. Some believe the gods created those laws, and some believe the laws created the gods. What they agree on is that gods, by nature of being gods, are exempt from many of these laws. They don't reincarnate except when they want to. They can see through the illusionary temptations of the universe. They don't accumulate karma, and they always behave righteously. But I wasn't a god, and I didn't know what that meant for me in these laws. And now that I knew M, I can no longer ignore caste. As much as I tried, I couldn't account for the positive points of a religion like Hinduism that would condemn an entire set of people because of their spot on an imaginary ladder. For me, everything about religion was connected to Aya and his teachings. And if he had lied about me being a god, maybe he had also lied about the existence of gods in general. And if he'd lied about that, maybe he'd also lied about the laws of the universe. What I did trust was the feeling I had deep inside me that said I wished to break free from him. I decided sitting in the pounding half darkness of the bar with my eardrums jumping, that it was time for me to start trying everything.
If you're following along at home, that was page, what, 238, 239, I believe, right around there. I love how it's in the moment with Kalki in, you know, in New York City, but then also goes forward a little bit, like in looking back at those different perspectives, even within that. Pre-COVID, you know, no COVID, let's say COVID's not an issue. Are you going, you get free tickets to go to see the Blueskin Gods band at Madison Square Garden. Are you going? Like, do you think are they like a good band, do you think?
When I was in my, you know, most of my 20s and early 30s, I would totally go to that band.
Okay.
Yeah. Nice. They're like mostly good, but they're sometimes kind of bad, and that's what makes them good.
Ooh. Did you have like an analog in your head? Like, are you thinking of them? Are they like totally beyond comparison? Or are you thinking like they're kind of like?
I don't have a specific analogy, but they're kind of like the sort of post-punk bands that I listened to in the early 2000s. Like they're, you know, where like everyone in the crowd sort of looks the same and is wearing like, you know, skinny jeans and a cardigan. But you know, some of the songs are really good and some of the songs you're like, kind of like, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes sense. That makes sense. What, you're very prolific. It's so cool. You're doing, you know, working in different genres, graphic novels and such. What's coming next?
So next is Shakti, which is a fantasy middle grade graphic novel illustrated by Nabi H. Ali, who is extremely talented illustrator that I'm very excited about. So that's coming out next summer. And it's about a young South Asian girl who harnesses the power of the goddesses Durga and Kali to perform magic.
Wow.
So it's about witches.
Yeah.
It takes place in New England during Halloween, which is my favorite thing. It's my favorite thing. Like Halloween in New England is fantastic. And then the year after, Tall Water, which is a YA graphic novel about a young girl, I guess a teenager, who gets caught in the 2004 tsunami that hit Sri Lanka.
Yes.
So it's you know, very different, very real, you know, very realist, more mature, but trying to look at questions of identity.
Gosh, it's been 18 years, 2004. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it'll come out on the 20th, near the 20th anniversary.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So Shakti is summer 2022 or summer 2023?
2023.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, we have some things to look forward to for sure. Man, I had so much fun. Thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you so much. These are great questions.
I appreciate that. Maybe we'll talk to you in, you know, when the ones come out in the future. So hopefully,
please,
not goodbye, right?
I would love to be back.
Oh man, what a pleasure. Been such a pleasure today talking to you, and thank you so much. Continued good luck with your writing. Continued great luck.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to episode 118 with SJ Sindhu. You can now subscribe to the Chills of Will podcast on Apple. Leave a 5-star review. You can also ask for it by name using Alexa. Find it on Stitcher, Spotify, and on Amazon Music. And I'm definitely minimizing those last two more recently. Spotify and Amazon, they don't need your business. Follow me on Instagram, where I'm at Chills of Will podcast, or on Twitter, where I'm at Chills of Will PO1. Sindhu, your social media info. I'm sorry.
It's at SJ Sindhu.
That's pretty hard to remember. Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's SINDU. SJSINDU. Thank you. You can watch this and other episodes on YouTube through the Chills at Will podcast channel. Please subscribe to both the YouTube and the podcast while you're checking out this episode. And please pass it on to a friend. This is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation, and I'd love for your help in promoting what I'm convinced is a unique and spirited look at an often ignored art form. The intro song for the podcast is Wind Down Instrumental. And the other song played on the episode was Hoops, instrumental by Matt Whitehour. Both songs are used through archesaudio.com. Please tune in for episode 119 with Disha Filia. Her debut short story collection, The Secret Lives of Church Ladies, won the 2021 Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction, and it focuses on Black women, sex, and the Black church, and it's now being adapted for television by HBO Max with Tessa Thompson executive producing. Disha is also a Kimbillo Fiction Fellow and will be the 2022-2023 John and Renee Grisham Writer-in-Residence at the University of Mississippi. That episode will air on April 19th. For now, thanks again for listening, and I hope that these quarantine days bring you texts by writers with mad skills like S.J. Sindhu, whose work, like Blue Skin Gods, gives you chills at will.